Colonel Burke, Reel 11.
Did one become very quickly infested with lice once one got in the trenches?
Well, I suppose you did, because contact with others, you see, if you leant against another man, well, some could come on to you. And there was nothing you could do about it. They were there and they bred. They sucked your blood and they lived in the seams of your trousers. Sometimes when it was fine weather, you'd see a man with a tin plate warming on a thing, and they'd be delousing themselves, as we call it, with their fingers. But then they suddenly each find a big one, they'd have a race, put them on this plate and make them race around the plate. That was the crude sort of amusement one got occasionally.
Were lice just an irritation, or were they more of an agony?
Oh, well, they're terrible. They get in your hair, they get in everything. They infest you.
They get in your hair, do they? I thought they were mainly body lice.
No, but you can get to the hair lice. I mean, in this last war, there was more lice in the ATS when they joined than anything else.
Yes, but I'm talking of the First War.
Yes, but you can get them in your hair, you see. But on the other hand, hair wasn't the length, wasn't kept the length. And the fellow preferred, because it was a nuisance, when they came out, the local barber or barbers, anyone would do it, hair clippers, you'd shave right off. So they couldn't bury themselves, and they didn't often get in your head, you know. Mm. Yes, that's terrible.
I see. Good. Perhaps you could finish off this period by telling me something about your own particular work and your own particular experiences during this period. You mentioned, for example, your commanding officer and how he created a few problems for you.
Oh, yes, well, I was then a platoon commander, so my next senior to me was my company commander. Any orders, if it was for me particularly to do the job, came through my company commander. And it was such a time in December when I was told I had to go out on a patrol. Well, it was a listening patrol and wire. See if I could cut some of the enemy wire. So that a few nights later we would do a raid. Well, we did that all successfully, four men. And going out you lead them, but coming back you come last. And we had stayed a tiny bit too long, and it was just getting dawn. Anyhow, it was enough to ISOs for the enemy to form a silhouette, and they started firing just as we were coming over the wire. And I was the last to cross, and I got hit in the foot, and I lost two toes. That was somewhere late December. That was the end of my first time in France.
One of the things that interests me particularly is food, the kind of food you had, how it was issued and how it was prepared. You've touched on this subject already, but I wonder if you could sort of just concentrate
on
it.
When you were back in billets, the regimental cooks cooked you stews and that sort of thing, roly-poly puddings and... But you had normal, more or less normal meals, you see. But there was no luxuries. I mean, occasionally you might have some bacon for breakfast. And but the big main meal was this stews, endless stews. And for tea, because you got jam and probably cheese.
This was when you were in billets?
When we were, yes, back in billets, but yes. There was no variety, ever. It was only at Christmas when the quartermaster had saved up some tea or something, and he'd go round from the farm and we could get eggs or chicken or something, or a small pig by paying for it, that we got a bit of variety at Christmas. Mm. That was the only time.
You've already talked about food in the French frontline trenches. Did your experiences during these first few months as regards the sort of food you got? Did they vary at all later in the war? Did things change in any ways?
No, it couldn't. You couldn't have cookers or men cooking in the front line because you didn't show a light. You were too close to the enemy. Another thing, the wind would carry the smoke and tell them something was doing. You see? Mm. No, the food never varied at all.
So throughout the war, as far as frontline meals were concerned, it was
bully beef,
bread and tea.
Occasionally you had what is known as a McConachie ration. That was a tin of stew, which you heated yourself, you see, by any means you had, or ate it cold. And there was Mr. Tickler, he was the main provider of jam. Well, I suppose it was the cheapest to do. It was plum and apple for the troops, but occasionally there was raspberry and strawberry, apricot, and even marmalade. But we never saw it. That went to the dressing stations and mostly the ASC who were bringing it up to us. They pinched all that.
Now, after you got wounded, what happened to you?
Well, I was taken to a field dressing station and then on down.
What happened at the field dressing station?
Well, they dress your wound properly because before that, when you're wounded, if you can't do it yourself, the stretcher bearers put on your field dressing, which you carry always in a certain place, which was under the flap of the tunic. They put on that. Well, it was only a piece of lint and a bandage and iodine. And you used to break the little phial of iodine, squirt it onto the wound, and then you were rushed off to the casualty clearing station, you see.
Where actually was the dressing station? In a trench?
Well, your dressing station, the battalion dressing station, was in the trenches, back by the CO.
It would be a sort of dugout, would it?
Yes. Your casualty clearing station was further back, tents. And then you were from the casualty clearing station, you were generally sent by train down to the base, Rouen, Havre, any of those places, where the doctors there, the Trapo, where the doctors made up their minds whether you should be sent to England or treated in France, go to a convalescent home and back to the line. Well, I came home.
Now, when you returned to France in April 1915, you went to Merville, and there you had a course training on
training. Well, when I left England, I was posted. My posting order was to join the Devons, 2nd Devons. But when I got to the base, they had suddenly, somebody had invented these trench mortars, and they had to form the batteries in France. So I was taken, instead of going to the Devons for the second time, and had to join this trench mortar battery.
At Merville?
At Merville, where yes. You had three weeks of training. And then you...
Tell me about the weapons and the sort of training you had.
Well, it was like a drain pipe with a collar around it and a base to hold the drain pipe up at whatever angle you wanted. And that was done by... You had a clinometer, which you placed on the thing, and set so many degrees was for a certain range. Now, these were nothing but just like a drain pipe, but they had a firing pin at the bottom of them. And the bomb was cylindrical, where it had a cartridge in the bottom. And you simply dropped it, and it slid onto this pin and burst. Now, if you had done your job properly, it went off. If you hadn't, it sometimes burst in the barrel with disastrous results to the people round about. You had a Bickford fuse, you see, which you had to set. And you set the fuse so many yards to the inch. Well, you might have the fuse, but if you tuck too much in, there wasn't enough sticking out, and it went off prematurely, you see. So you had to be very good at these things, and that was the original mortar which I was on. Mm.
How many men operated the mortar and what was the job of each?
Well, there were about six. One carried the base, one carried the mortar, and there were no tools. The other fellows carried the mortar shells and the cartridges. And you had four guns to a battery. And you had about 24 men.
And when you were operating the gun, how did you work as a team? What was the job of each thing? Could you describe it as a sort of scene?
Well, your guns were spaced out, you see, in the trenches, which the infantry loathed, because immediately they opened up fire, but the Germans would retaliate with artillery. And in this case, your guns might be spaced 10 yards apart. And so you had to get your men together, or the gun, number one, together, tell them what you wanted, what the range was, and what the target was, more or less, because you could never be really accurate with them, you see. And tell them that you would, that the sign to open fire would be the firing of number one.
Apart from this danger of the mortar bombs exploding, what other kind of routine or even exceptional difficulties or problems were involved with operating mortar guns?
Well, we were such a small unit with no reserves, and everybody came into the trench, is with you, that it was the fetching of our own ammunition from the battalion rendezvous, you see, whatever battalion you were attached to, and fetching your rations and fetching up all your shells, you see. Well, these were only about 10 or 12 pounds, I suppose. But on the other hand, you could get rid of a lot of them once you'd fix the cartridge in. It only was a case of dropping them in, and that was the case. But it never really became a crisis because, as I say, the infantry implored you not to fire. They loathed it. They were only too glad if you did run out of ammunition, because it always attracted the enemy fire and brought it down. Not on you so much, all over the trench system looking, trying to destroy you, you see.
Yes. I can see that why the troops would be a bit reluctant to have you blasting your mortars off, but on the other hand, the Germans were using these weapons quite largely and quite widely, and you were, in effect, the only means they had of reacting to.
Yes, but the Germans, the Minnewerfer, as it was called, was a much more accurate, and a much heavier, and a much bigger explosion than ours. And ours was just, I should imagine, a nuisance to the enemy. It wasn't until later on they got the Stokes mortar, which practically is the same, I think, mortar is used today, but did we achieve any real accuracy? And it could hurt the enemy and do damage. Mm.